Well, now we're going to hear from a contemporary of yours, a fine artist who has for his whole career played with advertising images in his work, James Rosenquist. Since the early 1960s, Rosenquist has painted these surreal, colorful montages of pop imagery, lipsticks and Day-Glow package designs, car parts and Coca-Cola labels.
Well, when I was at the Art Students League, I thought, where can I learn how to paint the Sistine Chapel? Where can I learn traditional mural painting? That's I want to really do it. See, the painters at Artcraft that were retiring when I was coming in, they were incredible painters. With a 3-4-inch brush, they could paint a whole battle scene. Like, they were just so facile. They were like incredible mural painters.
So out of advertising, out of that world, you
know. I was lucky to learn a lot of stuff. People said, well, isn't your fine art like billboards? I said, no, my billboards were fine art. Because I knew when I'd paint Gene Simmons or Gregory Peck or Burt Lancaster, I knew all the bones in the head. When they were from a photograph, it looked damn good. It wasn't just sort of a flat photo of a flat face.
And then at a certain point, did you stop for your own work, personal work, painting abstractions and start painting more like you were doing in your day job?
No. Yeah, I'll tell you exactly what happened. I mean, I was immersed in paint. I painted paint by the gallons and the gallons and gallons. I painted the Astor Victoria Theater 7 times, which is 395 feet wide and 58 feet high. With painted every imaginable thing.
It's about a half an acre of sign.
Yeah, no, seriously, you know, right up close, I would be painting a big Aero shirt, 2-3 stories tall, and the boss would come in and say, the neck looks dirty, you gotta change the neck. So I said, what? So I used to take the dirty neck color home. Then they'd say, the beer, they don't want pass, there's not enough hops in the beer. So I said, what do you mean? He said, you got to make it a little darker. And the whole beer glass, a little teeny weeny bit darker. And he said, okay, it'll pass. And I used to take this color home, and I made abstractions with wrong color. I call them the wrong color paintings.
Because it was billboard paint rather than
fine art
paint?
Yeah, it was crappy, bad paint, really bad. All the teachers in most art schools were teaching youngsters to express themselves. And I mean, just throw paint on the canvas and see what it says. All of a sudden, it seemed that the aesthetic of the dripped, splashed paint seemed old-fashioned. It seemed redundant. It seemed there already was good guys doing that, including Bill de Kooning, who was a very good friend of mine. They were doing that, and they were well-known, and it seemed to be ridiculous to follow in those footsteps. You learn from it, but you don't do it. Young artists come along, they copy someone else, and they get sort of semi-known for it. But they never had those. I mean, I never lived Jackson Pollock's life, thank God.
You wouldn't be here talking to me if you had.
No, God, no.
Should we go out and look at some paintings? So this is President-elect.
Yeah.
Which is dominated by this big figure of Jack Kennedy's face.
Yeah. See, while painting billboard signs and everything, I was always fascinated how people advertise themselves. He wasn't pres yet. This was done during the Eisenhower days. I saw him, actually, wearing a baby blue suit, sitting on the back of a car down on Broad Street, this jaundiced face and his light-colored hair. I thought, God, he looks like an advertisement, okay? So then I said, what is his campaign promise, a piece of cake and a Chevrolet? It was kind of like that kind of a joke. And that's what it was.
So we have the front fender of a Chevrolet and a piece of cake here.
It took on now, it's a total different context because the legacy of his family. And I think in other people's minds it changed, but to me it still remained the same as this yellow jauntist guy as a campaign promise, a self-advertising. It still remains the same with me.
As we approach F-111, which is 80 feet long, is...
86 feet.
Well, there's the F-111 jet obviously goes all the way around, but
yes.
Then there are other fractured images pasted over it, like a chrome-plated
It's a hairdryer with a little gorilla girl, which I wanted to be like a metaphor of the
the pilot of this aircraft going through this flak of the economy, something like that. The ideas for this picture came from a multiplicity of ideas, and one was visiting an amusement park and seeing a B-36 corroding quietly away. We were well into the Cold War with Russia, with this big waste of energy that was producing obsolete war weapons and not hospitals and so on. So that kind of idea. And I thought of my life as a big joke. I thought of my existence as a joke. Just ridiculous.
This was your existentialism, your North Dakota existentialism?
Yeah. It was a big joke because all this economy was giving families a house, 2.5 children, and 3.5 cars.
And then obviously here you have a mushroom cloud.
Yeah, like at a resort. If you're in a resort in Nevada and they're blowing off a...
Oh, because and you have a kind of a beach umbrella
right.
Overlapped with the mushroom cloud.
Yeah, a little snow on it. Yeah.
Now this is, as a kid who grew up with the... That was the Skelly logo, wasn't it?
It's Mobile Gas.
Oh, Mobile Gas.
And I used when I was there, these older these the kids, I used to pull a little wagon saying, my daddy sells Mobile Gas.
So you use pieces of Tide boxes and all kinds of corporate logos. Here we have a mobile oil flying horse.
Sure.
No lawyers ever sent you letters threatening you or things like the mobile logo? No? Did mobile ever come out after you and say,
why? Why would they? I got a lawyer joke. God was having a big argument with the devil and he got so tired of it, he's going to sue the devil. And then the devil says, where are you going to get a lawyer? No. If you see an image in a magazine, like I have some of these, and I paint it from that. I'm painting from a contemporary landscape. You have to know the law.
I think you could give me an autograph?
Sure.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Let me write on his back. There you go.
Thank you so much.
Sure. This suite of pictures is for the Guggenheim Deutsche Bank Museum in Berlin. The title is The Swimmer in the Econo-Mist.
Well, the swirl effect is what makes one think that it's...
Well, this is like almost like clothes in an automatic washer, you know, and the imagery is from soap boxes.
Now, you have fragments of Picasso's Guernica in
this work. Yeah, it's an abstraction.
You haven't done that so much, have specific references to
that. Never, hardly ever, because I think, hey, baby, I'm living right now. Now is the time. There's such an abundance of idea around anyway, so why talk about the past?
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
It was fun.
I got a couple more jokes. But
you can see some of James Rosenquist's work at our website, studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson. My guest today is the advertising legend George Lois. Rosenquist mentioned to me when I was talking to him that what connected him to the other big guns of pop art, Andy Warhol and Roy Lichtenstein, was that they were all commercial artists before they became fine artists. I wondered what you thought of their work when it first came out back in the early 60s.
Well, obviously, it was seemingly fresh and different. Maybe I know too much, but, you know, if you know the history of art with the Dadaists, and it was the extreme extension of that kind of a point of view. I mean, Andy took photographs and forced the photographs to a real black and white kind of look and used photographs all the time, you know. Of course, I knew him when he was hawking his drawings around town. What's interesting about what Vosger was talking about is the outdoor posters he talks about that these guys paint, you know, and they were pretty terrific. When Cleopatra, the movie Cleopatra, was getting all that publicity in America, and Hal called me up and said, hey, we're going to get a terrific story about Cleopatra. It's really going to be hot. Blah, 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 blah.
Which was, again, for our younger listeners, was the Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton movie, and probably the first time that an entertainment product was the story of the day. Everybody was talking about nothing else.
That night, I was going down Broadway, and I looked, And in front of the Rialto Theater, there's a gigantic poster being painted, a Cleopatra poster. And it was Burton, you know, as Mark Antony, I guess, you know, and he's leaning over across, you know, Elizabeth Taylor's shoulder. And just past her cleavage, with the bottom part of it unpainted. And there were, and I saw that thing and I said, oh, my God, what an Esquire cover. And the next morning I was up there 7 o'clock in the morning and I said, stop. And I got a Carl Fisher photographer to come and we took a room across the street. We went up and we took a shot of them. I gave him $20 a piece to go back and to retouch the cleavage a little bit. And that was the cover of Esquire.
That's amazing.
I got these two guys, you know, working on the cleavage of the Cleopatra poster.
A moment ago, you mentioned you met Andy Warhol when he was just a commercial artist going around hawking his drawings. He was trying to get work from you?
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. I mean, you could see the kid could draw. But he used a kind of a blotting technique. It was kind of a ripoff of an artist by the name of David Stone Martin, who would drag his pen on a paper that would blot, and or Ben Shahn, who used to kind of drag it and zing it a little bit. And he did these very elegant little sweet drawings of shoes, et cetera. And he really made his living for 3-4 years all over Massachusetts doing that.
It's so interesting.
A pre-wig, by the way.
Yeah. It's so interesting. Here's Andy Warhol, as you say, being influenced by fine artists like Ben Shahn and others. James Rosenquist, as he's doing his billboards, told me he's obviously being influenced by his own art historical education. And then these guys become big artists who then in turn influence advertising all over again.
Absolutely. I mean, the point they're making about Andy, which you caught, was the fact that he spent a lot of time. I mean, every day he was in an ad agency, all the ad agencies, you know, going up, talking to everybody, very charming, you know, kind of blushingly sweet, you know, kid from Pittsburgh, et cetera. And, you know, he became this icon, you know.
So it wasn't, and so his stuff and the rest of the pop art movement wasn't simply an outsider's critique of the consumer culture. They were in it.
Oh, they were smack in the middle of it.
George Lois is my guest today, and we'll talk some more after the break. In a minute, jingles may be becoming obsolete, but somehow they still get stuck in our heads. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.